I'm the doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that goes on forever and ever and ever, and you all love it. We're back to look at those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith, and once more I'm joined by Paul's bitch.
Me, Dina Peters. I mean, fair, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very private in-joke for the pair of us, and probably about a few other listeners, but yes, yeah, it's made us laugh. Yes, we've been joined once again by Belgium's number one Paul McGann fan, probably Belgium's number one Doctor Who fan, let's be honest. And yes, it's a joy to have you back. Welcome back, Tina.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on once again.
It's a pleasure. And you join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen in books, novellas, full cast audios, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, magazines, and more. You could probably have said that off the top of the head because you've listened to this podcast so often.
I mean, I've listened to everything, so yeah. Yeah. I'm full up to date. No, I haven't listened to all of the EDA book ones because I haven't read them all and I don't want spoilers.
But right. Yeah. That makes sense. That does make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So this week we've got an exclusive chat as we hear from the writer of the Eighth Doctor audio for the first time.
That's true. We're about to be joined live from Finland, not from Belgium, by Jonathan Clement. We're very European this week, aren't we? Because we love Europe.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Europe is awesome.
It is. And if any of our listeners voted for Brexit, then I'm incredibly disappointed in you because we like to befriend everyone.
Yeah, me too. I hate Brexit.
Yeah. And as we were saying before we recorded, it's made it a hell of a lot more difficult for you to come to the UK.
It does. Also more expensive. Yeah, not fun.
Yeah. Anyway, I'd chat about Immortal Beloved with Jonathan, which was the fourth adventure, but the third story to feature Lucy Miller.
Ah, Lucy Miller. We love her.
Lovely. We do. Far too much. yes. Sorry. Get my head out of there.
Out of the gutter.
Yes. You know me far too well. This story was first broadcast on BBC 7 back in the 21st of January 2007. My God, that's so long ago. And it was released on CD by Big Finish in April that year. What were you? Would you have been doing in April 2007, Tina? How old would you have been?
I was 19. So I was probably still in school, although I started working in 2008. So my last year of school then.
Wow. Oh my God. I feel ancient.
Long time ago. I feel already ancient, like, ugh.
That's because you hang around with 20-somethings.
Yeah, true. All of my friends are like, not all of them, but most of them are like a decade younger. I'm like, no.
Now you know how I feel when I'm chatting with you.
Sorry.
It could be worse. We could be chatting with Becca and our absent friend on her maternity leave. And as we record, just had a text from her a wee minute or two ago saying that she's still not had the baby yet and still at home with a laughing emoji. So, of course, by the time people hear this episode, the baby will be about
Have given birth, yeah.
Well, the way her luck's going at the moment, no, it'll be hanging in there for a while longer, so... Oh, dear. Anyway, before we move on, Tina, could you please tell us a little bit more about Immortal Beloved, which comes from the webpage at www.bigfinish.com, please?
I can. Theosophy? Ha! Surely you mean Theophany. Because we're not talking about real gods here, are we? We are talking about appearance of gods. Your heavenly powers are a little too mechanical for my liking. And if I may be so bold, Lord Zeus, your demeanor is not very godlike. And now let's hear the official trailer.
In the next episode of Doctor Who...
I, Sarati of the Green Groves...
Take thee, Prince Kalkin.
Take thee, Prince Kalkin.
To be my husband.
To be my husband.
In defiance of parents, gods, and men.
In defiance of parents, gods, and...
What in the world?
Is this part of the ceremony?
You know me, I can't even find Blackpool in a TARDIS.
Wow! Look at the sky, it's...
Lucy! Stand back now. It is beginning.
It's ending, Taden! You're killing yourself! No!
It's what
every emperor, every pharaoh dreamed of.
But if the machine is malfunctioning, the copies aren't perfect.
Portal of cleansing? Portal of perving, more like.
But is this the planet of idiots?
I am Hera, goddess of... whatever I'm goddess of.
I am Prince Kalkin of Kaliva.
A prince? Fantastic! I am Lucy of the M62. And this is my bumbling assistant, the Doctor.
How flattering.
Immortal beloved.
Well, Tina, how did you find this one?
I liked it. I already heard it once, but I had to re-listen to it, and I really liked it. Halfway through, I'm like, I think I remember this. And then the whole switch happened, and we're like, yes, that's what was happening here. They're like, oh, no. It's a spoilers, but when you find out what they were and what was happening, I'm like, oh, I remember the first time being so confused. I'm like, what's going on? I like this. Also, I like Lucy. She's so, like, she doesn't take shit from anyone, and I love that.
Absolutely, no. I think she's great. I've loved Sheridan for a long time, but I just think Lucy and Sheridan together is just the perfect combination mm-hmm. for me. And I think it's a great story because there's all these terms like the magic wands and things like that for gun, and the chariots yeah. for helicopters, and all these things. I think it's wonderful bit of world building. You think, what on earth is going on here?
Yeah, in the beginning, the first time I honestly thought they were like in some medieval place, and then I was like, it's a helicopter. No, that can't be medieval.
And particularly when you've got all the gods' names there as well, and it does me think what's going on. But then, of course, there's a very good science fiction explanation for it all.
Yeah, there is.
Yep. Did you have any favorite moments?
Basically, when Lucy was about to deck. Oh, what was it called again? What was his name again? I'm not gonna say too much in case of, again, spoilers. But when they think they switched and they haven't. And yes. Lucy is about to, like, full deck him in the face. I love that moment.
Yeah, to get Taden as it was. Yeah. No, my particular favorite bit is when she's arriving and they're going into the decontamination chamber, and you can see through her clothes.
The clothes are see-throughs, yeah. I knew where you were going with this as soon as you said that.
It's funny. You can tell that people know that I do like Lucy Miller far too much.
No.
It also shows that we chat quite a lot as well, and
we do
very, very well. So I'll say something that I've just, you know, I'm sure that other listeners will be wondering is that, how do you find, with English not being your first language, how do you find Big Finish to listen to?
Sometimes very hard, because also, especially like in Stranded, they used a lot of jokes about what was on the television at the time. And I had friends have to explain it to me, because I was like, I don't get it, when they made jokes about watching people watch TV, or what was it again? I'm like, huh? What? I was just so confused. Sometimes people do have to explain them to me.
Yeah, like Gogglebox. That was the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I honestly had no idea what the hell they were talking about. I'm like, huh? But overall, I like it, although I miss a lot of the puns and inside jokes, because obviously I don't watch that much British television, especially not now with Brexit not having BBC 1 and 2 and 3 anymore. So
you Brexit. For me, that whole first season of Stories with Lucy is, it just reinvigorated my love of Doctor Who on audio in particular, because it was just, I mean, the show was great at the time when Donna was about to come up in TV and such like, and
yeah,
it was just so much fun. And I think it reminds you that Doctor Who can be an awful lot of fun.
I mean, but that's exactly the fun thing about it, that it brings like important discussions to the table, and it has important things happening in it. But at the same time, it's still sometimes a little bit silly and sometimes a little bit fun, and it combines them perfectly. I mean, at least in my opinion, they do.
Agree. I mean, this one, you look at it, is quite a serious issue that, you know, talking about cloning yourself and putting your mind into a body so that you can continue to live on. But
live forever,
then, of course, and then you've got somebody, you're killing yourself to carry on living.
I mean, it's you, but at the same time, it isn't. So basically, you're killing someone. And I love that also on with the TV show, they bring those type of topics, that they bring them to the table, and yet it's still like, you don't realize you're watching something that's so serious because they make it fun, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It's like in Planet of the Ood, when they're talking about the Oods are the ones who do all the manufacturing, and it's effectively a comment on child labor and slave labor in third world countries. And it's like,
Or like the one with the 13 Doctor, the one they did about the environment. Yeah, sorry, I suck at titles, so don't ask me what it was called again. But like, that's an important thing to bring up, and I love that they did it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, I think, do you know what? I'm just going to say it out loud. I love this one. It's simple as that. It's great fun, great cast, and I love it to bits.
Yeah, me too. I like it as well. I mean, love maybe not, but it's definitely in one of the fun ones. I'll say it like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So enough praise for this one.
And Stelly, what's the, how would you say Finland in Belgium?
Finland is the same thing.
Oh, there we go. I just wondered in case.
Yeah, but our land is more land. You say more land. Yeah, I mean, I can't really explain it, but we say kind of similar.
Yeah, because I think it's the Scottish thing. We say Finland.
Then we kind of say the same thing.
Yeah.
We say it more like the Germans, so yeah.
Yeah, oh, and Scottish and German can be quite the same because both can be quite guttural and knock. Aye. And yeah. Anyway, over to you, Jonathan.
My name is Jonathan Clements, and I'm the author of Immortal Beloved.
Jonathan, welcome to Pieces of Eight. Always a joy to have somebody who I've been chatting with for the best part of almost nearly two decades, and finally getting to chat properly in person like this again.
Yeah, and there's kind of running joke, but for long-term listeners will not know this about Kenny, but every time he tried to email me about something Big Finish related, I'd always be somewhere weird. And so I'm looking back over our old emails, and it's like, oh, I can't talk right now. I'm on a bullet train in Japan, or I'm in Taipei Airport, or I'm up a mountain in Guangxi or something. And I don't think we've ever spoken in the British Isles, except in person one day when we actually met. So apart from that, everything's been conducted kind of, at the top of a giant spike somewhere in the Himalayas.
But yes, it's nice to be able to chat properly. But you're, of course, you are currently international as we speak.
I'm very international, yes. I live in Finland. I'm actually now a Finn. I have become a Finnish citizen post-Brexit. So I'm actually in Finland most of the time. And indeed, I was in Finland when Immortal Beloved was being recorded, which is why I'm not on the CD extras.
So would you say that you're a big Finnish? Anyway, I'll move swiftly on.
Oh, yeah, because I've never heard that joke before. Please continue.
Ba-doom. Yes, quite. So let's wind back. So, do you remember the first time you saw the TV movie with Paul McGann?
No.
Sorry. That was a quick one.
I remember when it was coming out, and I think, what year was it? Can you just
96.
Please
remind? May 22nd, 96, it was in video.
Okay, I just moved to London. I just finished my master's degree in Scotland, and I come down to London, and I had probably just been fired from a very brief comics job, and so I was a full-time translator at that point and kind of writing about anime and stuff. So I must have watched it in my flat in Leytonstone around that time. I do remember seeing it. I remember being incredibly impressed that they managed to get Eric Roberts, and quite pleased with Paul McGann as well. I felt, we now know he was much maligned because of the amount of other Doctor work that he's done, but of course at the time there was even a joke in Queer as Folk written by Russell T. Davis that if you have to list all the Doctors, McGann doesn't count, which was very unfair, and I'm glad that the posterity has erased that.
Absolutely. You must have been delighted when you got the email from Gary Russell to this exclusive coterie inviting you to take part in a new McGann series.
I was, yeah. And in fact, I just reread that email today because this is such a long time ago that I really did have to go back and look at my own correspondence. I'd completely forgotten it was Gary that approached me. Yes, I do remember Gary saying, okay, we've got this thing coming up. It's McGann, and it's going to be on BBC 7. And as a result of that, we need it quickly. We need it really fast. And that was the main issue, which was that. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into here, but this is a story that actually goes back to 2003, when I did Judge Dredd, Trapped on Titan. which was written in an incredible hurry in order to pull Big Finish out of a problem that was A, entirely imaginary, and B, of their own making, and C, which turned out to mean to be completely benign as well, that it didn't really make any difference. But as a result, I had to write this really fast, and the recording went very badly. And we were all quite miserable. It was all fixed in post. It's lovely now, but we'd felt on the day that it had really kind of been running off the rails, and it was partly my fault because it was such an unwieldy script. We basically recorded the first draft. And unlike most Big Finish recording days, there was not a huge exodus to the pub afterwards. Everybody kind of went home quite dejected. And I ended up on my own with Toby Longworth, drowning our sorrows in Brixton. And he said to me, would you consider writing a Strontium Dog that featured Sanjeev Bhaskar? Because he knew him through Goodness Gracious Me, and he said, you know, I think he's a really great actor, and it would be really cool if we could get him to play some kind of baddie in Strontium Dog. And so I've been sort of thinking about that, toying over this idea for a Strontium Dog pitch in my head, which was going to be called Kingmaker, and was going to be about the bounty hunters chasing this criminal to a planet, and they let off a time bomb, and the planet goes from being completely barren to being covered with cities in a second, and they realize they've gone back in time and they set up a civilization on this planet, and when they go down there, it turns out they're cloning themselves repeatedly, and the idea was that Sanjeev Bhaskar was the whole thing was going to be kind of very, very Indian in its outlook. It was going to be based on reincarnation and kind of inspired by Roger Zelazny's Lord of Light, with the idea that the crew of the ship are reincarnating themselves, are cloning themselves and loading their minds into new bodies. And so the idea for the Strontium Dogs would be, if you're arresting the 150th generation clone of somebody, are you arresting the person who committed the crime? What's the issue on jurisdiction? What's the issue on the statute of limitations and so on? And the Strontium Dog was all cancelled. So the only thing that kind of came out of that at the end was firstly the fact that I had a reputation for being able to write a script quickly, and secondly that I had Kingmaker sitting around. And so when Gary said we need this fast, again I have to kind of leap back in time again and say, after Kingmaker didn't happen, I think it was John Ainsworth came to me and said, we need a script for the Richard E. Grant animated series. We're going to do, after Scream of the Shalka, we're going to do another one, and we're taking pictures for Richard E. Grant. And so I blew the dust off Kingmaker, and I changed the names to Doctor Who and his companions and the Master, and I shunted that off. And that went through the process at the BBC right the way up to the commissioning stage, when it came in second behind something called Blood of the Robots, which I suspect was Blood of the Daleks eventually. And then that got cancelled. And then Gary Russell sends this email, and I remember saying to John Ainsworth, if speed is of the issue, why don't we sell Kingmaker? The BBC have already approved it through all of these stages, so we know that there's a certain amount of approvals that have already, of boxes that have already been ticked, basically. So I was very open. I said, look, I've got this thing lying in a drawer. I think it's going to fit. Why don't we do that? So I changed the title to Sins of the Father, although my personal favourite was always Karma Police. That's what I really wanted to call it. And we send that off. And so that's how this kind of... So basically it was a three-year process of this kind of thing that had been written in various different stages, eventually ending up on their desk as the pitch that will become Immortal Beloved. And what that meant for me was that it was incredibly matured by that point. You know, it wasn't written on the back of a beer mat. It was 3,500 words long. And so, and for me, that was just lovely, because the original Richard E. Grant's was supposed to be 2 hours, I think. So what that meant is that I had 2 hours worth of material. I had a 3,500 word outline. The script I was supposed to write for Immortal Beloved was only 10,000 words long. So I only had to add like 2 words for every one that was already written, and it would be done. It was basically like filling in a form at that point. Which is very rare for me, because normally I'm terrible at outlining, and I find myself having to fix my own problems, you know, like changing the tires on a moving car, because, you know, you're up against a deadline. So that was very nice to me. It was a very easy process for me writing it compared to a lot of other scripts.
Yeah, that's fab. I love the whole Genesis story there, because I know we talked about it many moons ago in the fanzine. Mm. Of course, then along comes Lucy Bleeding Miller. Of course, at this point, she hadn't been cast as Sheridan, and just who instantly found the voice and the character. So how did you find writing for her when you weren't sure of an actress at that point?
I didn't let it trouble me particularly. I kind of worked on this. I mean, we'd been told that she was going to be Northern, but it wasn't quite clear where. And we were told that she was going to be Bolshy. And so I kind of made her everybody's irritating elder sister coming in and tutting at Doctor Who on the television. I thought that was my idea. I thought it would be kind of fun, for my script at least, is as if Lucy thought she was the heroine in her own story and the Doctor was just her sidekick. And that kind of made it through to the end, so no one kind of worried about that. As far as I'm concerned, the ultimate Lucy line is actually in Max Warp, when she calls the TARDIS a shed. You know, she's so contemptuous. And what I love about that is the way that she completely renders mundane all of the science fictional wonder that goes on in Doctor Who, which I love. I mean, a recurring issue in a lot of my scripts for everybody, and something that people have pointed out, including Alan Barnes on many occasions, is I like to render the wondrous entirely every day. I want to talk, you know, the fact that I'm talking to you now at 1,000 miles remove in real time and you're recording it onto a digital device is really amazing, but we're just acting like it's completely normal. And I think that's how people should behave in science fictional futures as well. I really much prefer it when we talk about what's known as the integral accident. Like, everyone comes up with a new piece of technology, but then that creates new problems for everybody that no one predicted before. And so Lucy, for me, is kind of like that. She's very annoyed at all of the whistles and bells that are supposed to make, you know, come from this amazing future aren't working for her, including the fact that the Doctor can't even find, you know, Blackpool on a map. So that was how I worked before she arrived. And I didn't have to change a whole lot after she turned up, because the thing about Sheridan Smith, uniquely among any actor that I've ever worked with, is that she could take what I had written, deliver exactly what I wanted without me having to be there to explain it, and then add something special entirely of her own that I was never expecting. And the level of achievement for an actor, you know, is, you know, you could be like Hitchcock and say, well, they're just casual. As long as they read it out and stand in the right place, that's fine. But obviously what you want from an actor is someone for whom your script will be the most important thing in their world the day that they're recording it, and for them to deliver it exactly the way you want it. For someone to go above and beyond that, to deliver a tone or an attitude that I wasn't even expecting, to find something in the words that I didn't know was there, is a very rare and unique skill. And so I just kept writing Lucy the way that I was, absolutely convinced that, you know, whatever Sheridan Smith did would be better than I was expecting.
Which is wonderful. But as anybody who knows me will know, I do love Sheridan, probably a little bit too much. But
I don't know if we can talk about this on the podcast, but a couple of years ago, she kind of suffered a degree of Twitter cancelling and criticism over a performance that she was in the West End, I think. And I remember wading into a number of Facebook fights and saying, Sheridan Smith is not the problem. If there's something going on here, you know, questioning her acting skills is absolutely off the table, because I've seen what she can do, and I've seen the raw material, and I've seen what she did with it, and I know that she is a very rare talent.
Yes, completely agreed. I think I joined into similar debates on Twitter, so, well, they're not really debates, they're shouting matches on Twitter, but c'est la vie.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, everyone's got an opinion about actors and indeed about scripts. I mean, something that I find quite weird personally is that when someone says they don't like my fiction, it doesn't bother me in the slightest, because everyone can have an opinion about fiction. When someone has a negative opinion about the facts I'm providing, I get really angry with them, because they're facts, and facts don't care about your feelings. And I suppose it's the same way with actors as well. I have had numerous run-ins with actors who I haven't been particularly impressed with, but I did grow up among actors, and I know what they can do when they're really, really good. And Big Finish have got really quite amazing people over the years doing some quite amazing things. But sometimes it's not clear where the amazing is. And so, yeah, I was very pleased to see what she did with with the stuff that I'd written, and it was always a joy. It was always a surprise. As I said, with most actors, you're just happy if they do what you tell them to do, and you get the performance that you want. But to get something that you didn't even expect is very different.
Yeah, she definitely is a talent, and I'm not quibbling over your facts at all. I agree with everything. Next, I think maybe if we chat about the world building you did here, the fact that it's the everyday, the mundane, and everything's been given these more mystical names, which still makes me laugh every time I listen to it. And I suppose that must have been fun.
Let me ask you, Kenny, which one makes you laugh the most?
Oh, is it... I think just fire with the guns being wands.
Magic wands. Okay, yeah. That's interesting. Right, because so the guns being magic wands. That's my idea. The one that made me laugh the most was Ether Trumpet.
Yes,
which I didn't write. That smells very much of Nick Briggs. Mm-hmm. Ether Trumpet for a walkie-talkie. Yeah. Okay, so if you want to talk specifically about the weird names of things. So the idea in Mortal Beloved, for those that don't know, is that the crew of the ship that originally arrived there, the colony ship that arrived there, have set themselves up as gods, very much in the style of Lord of Light, and they, when their bodies get old, they swap their minds into a new, younger clone, and they carry on. And in order to maintain this very precarious 1% situation, they have lied to the general population about all the technology that they use. One of the first manifestations of that in the script is where someone says, you know, put away that magic wand, and then you hear a gunshot. And that was inspired directly by the Dungeon Master's Guide by Gary Gygax, because when you read through the original Advanced Dungeons and Dragons rules, when you see how they describe wands and staves and whatever the thing in the middle is, rods, they have a set number of charges, and you can take them to a specialist to have the charges replaced. And this was just when Gamma World was coming out, and they were talking about kind of fantasy adventure in a post-apocalyptic world, and I thought, they're describing guns. They're talking about guns here. That's really cool. And in at least one of the D&D campaigns that I ran, I did deliberately have guns as magic wands, and I didn't tell the players. I didn't not tell them. I waited for them to work it out, and they were very angry with me when they found out. So that's where the wands thing came from, and they kind of ran with that elsewhere. Ether Trumpet made me laugh when I first heard it, and it makes me laugh every time. That's a word for a walkie-talkie, but I'm afraid it wasn't mine. It was not my line. And I think Alan Barnes came up with one of the reversals of that towards the end, where we're trying to describe how remote synaptical kinesis won't work because there's not enough memory metal, which was me. And Alan Barnes went, are you trying to tell me the human photocopy has run out of toner? And I thought, that's such a Lucy thing to say,
yeah,
that we'll throw that in. So yes, there was a lot of that going on. And I felt it lent itself really well to audio. There is a film project that I worked very briefly on a while ago, which was to adapt a book set in post-apocalyptic London. And we had real problems with it because the whole point of the book was they were describing London after the apocalypse, but things were being used in different ways, like the Tate Gallery was now a marketplace and so on. And so the joy of reading it, the joy of discovery, was in finding out those things as you read it, realizing what they were talking about. And of course, in a film, that's still visual. You see it immediately. So it's very difficult to maintain that kind of that sense of surprise, that sense of wonder. In audio, it's much easier because I say magic wand and you assume you know what I'm talking about until you hear a gun go off.
Yeah.
So I think that was quite a handy means of helping to convey the world in that way. Alan Barnes actually had a really good note for me, which I only saw the other day. When I was doing this interview, and I went back and read his notes on the script because I thought I'd better try and remember what people said. And he came up with something really smart, which I clearly ignored and didn't do anything with. And that was that he said, you've got these faceless minions. You've got these, you know, these men doing the bidding of the gods, these kind of troops and everything. He said, but what you haven't got here is Doctor Who points. Because if they're just minions, they're just minions. Can we give them some kind of quirk? Can we give them some kind of, you know, look or description that makes them the sort of thing we could turn into an action figure? I mean, we're not saying let's turn them into action figures, but I'm saying that that's how Doctor Who works. That, you know, you don't just have a bunch of soldiers. You should have a bunch of soldiers with a particular thing about them. And I thought that was a really interesting insight into the kind of way that Whovian world building works, which I unfortunately ignored.
Well, what's the point in having instructions if you've got to follow them? Bend the rules a little, or break them.
Well, it's sad. It's sad because Alan is the best script editor I've ever worked with, and he doesn't come to you and say, "That's rubbish, do it again." He goes, "That's rubbish. This is why. This is how you can fix it. Or do something better than what I've just described." But he never leaves you in the lurch. He always gives you a reason for why he doesn't like something, and then explains exactly how to fix it. So for me to go, "Well, that's a great idea, Alan," and then ignore him completely, must have been a bad day, I suppose.
And what a great cast you were given, you know, with Ian McNeice as Use and late Elspeth Gray as Hera, just leading the cast. Really, really impressive performers.
Yes, I wrote the part of Zeus with Baron Harkonnen in mind, entirely unaware that he'd been played by Ian McNeice on the Sci-Fi Channel. So, you know, they just shoved him into that slot perfectly. And I was very touched on listening to the CD extras to hear Elspeth Gray basically saying, not that she'd retired, but that she didn't want to play granny sitting in wheelchairs, and she would only leave the house for a good part, of which this was one. And so I thought that was very sweet to see that she'd seen something in this character that made it worth getting out of bed for, which was very, very nice. And she has this line about getting old, which I took directly from my grandmother, which she said in exactly the same way, like, "Don't get old," a real kind of warning. Of course, my grandmother did not have access to cloning technology, she didn't get out of it.
And of course, there was a slight surprise for you with an extra character appearing, with young Jake McGann popping up as Ganymede.
I wasn't very happy about that, I have to say. With 17 years hindsight, listening to the show again, as I did yesterday, I think it's relatively harmless. And I can see the dramatic role that Ganymede performs. The idea that there's someone who really wants to be the replacement of Zeus, who's desperate to give himself up for it. It's a nice touch. So I have to concede that. What annoyed me about it is that I don't write parts for children if I can possibly avoid it. Because, you know, we've got enough problems in the studio without having to kind of wrangle child actors as well. And there was this sense in the journalism around Immortal Beloved, or at least this is my memory of it, which may be wrong, that, you know, I'd written this part in the script and everyone was going, "Oh, who should we cast? Who should we cast? Oh, no. Oh, by a remarkable coincidence, the leading man's son's shown up at the studio today." And I thought that was a bit annoying, because I didn't write that part. It wasn't there. It was a surprise to me when it showed up. You know, we do make concessions to actors about this sort of thing. I mean, we've had to do it on, you know, one or two occasions, and it's mostly harmless. But you know, it did grate with me that, in my mind, I was being set up as someone who'd written this uncastable part, which had been ever so fortunately cast by virtue of someone being related to the lead. That left a nasty taste in my mouth, really.
Looking back on it now, you look at the whole package, and I think it's a great story. It stands up well. It's entertaining. It's got a bit of romance in there, and just shows that older people can love too. And there's a lot of fun to it as well, particularly with Lucy in the chamber and You can see through my clothes.
Audio smut. Yes. Alan Barnes called it Romeo and Juliet with clones. And originally, in the 2-hour version, as written as Kingmaker, there was a lot more of that. There was this idea. In fact, I think what would happen is Sarati poisoned herself in order to kill Hera, so that when Hera's mind goes into her body, the body then dies. So there was a much more kind of Romeo Juliet setup, and in fact, there's only a little bit of that left at the end in the show now, where Lucy goes, "Oh, it's lovely, you're in love, just like Romeo and Juliet," and the doctor goes, "Is that a good thing?" She goes, "Nope, it's not a good thing." I mean, I personally hate Romeo and Juliet as a play. I couldn't care less about two love-struck teenagers making drama for everybody else around them. But I really, really like the idea of what happens after Happily Ever After, and something, you know, that struck me as a stranger listening to my own script after you know, maybe 15 years since I last heard it, was, you know, the sudden kind of frisson that you get when you realize that these two horrible old people and these two starstruck young lovers are the same people, and that one becomes the other, which becomes the other, which becomes the other. And that's a really great idea, I think, even if I say so myself. Because it puts the Doctor in this impossible situation. Like, is he going to support the young versions who are full of idealism and hope? Or is he going to pander to the whims of the old versions who are the older versions of the young versions? You know, there's this incredible cyclical problem, which and the Doctor, we believe, breaks that cycle. And I think I didn't make it clear whether he did it deliberately or not, whether it was just a mistake or whether it was an act. You know, he deliberately decided to cock up the transfer of the memories. And that was not a failure of the writing. That was me being deliberately ambiguous, because I didn't know myself whether the Doctor was going to do that or not. I kind of left it to people to decide themselves, you know, just how incompetent he was with all the switches and knobs. So I think listening to it in hindsight, it feels like an episode of Doctor Who, which is what I consider to be a very robust thing for a 17-year-old script.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us in Pieces of Eight today. It's been a real joy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Jonathan for taking the time to join us in his first ever Doctor Who podcast chat, and hopefully we'll hear from him again in the future to chat about Brave New Town.
Absolutely. Tina, did you enjoy that one?
I did. I love it. I mean, excellent. I just always love hearing from the authors. Like, it's so fun.
Yep.
Well, why don't we have another and speak with one of the cast? We're going to be joined by David Dobson, who played Tayden and Aeris.
Yes. My name is David Dobson, and I played Tayden / Aeris in Immortal Beloved.
Welcome to Pieces of Eight, David. It's a real joy to speak to somebody from one of my favourite Big Finish audios.
Oh, fantastic.
Do you remember how you came to be cast in this, and were you much of a Doctor Who fan? Did you know too much about the show?
Oh, I was a huge Doctor Who fan. I mean, there's no underestimation to say that I was a Doctor Who fan. It was my childhood was Doctor Who. I was doing Panto with Barnaby Edwards, and during said Panto, and this is 2005, I think, or 2006, I discovered that he was a Dalek, and obviously a very, very strong, the friendship was born immediately. And then, yes, a very sometime shortly after that Panto, yeah, he got me in for my first Big Finish audio. And it was a complicated one to do as your first one. I mean, my strong memory of it was, I was playing a 40-year-old general, his 18-year-old clone, then his 18-year-old clone with the mind of the 40-year-old general in it. I mean, after years and years of doing Big Finish, that's just classic Big Finish for me now. That's pretty much what you do. I'm also killing myself. I've killed myself quite a few times on Doctor Who on Big Finish audios.
It must have been a bit of a dream come true then for you to get here. You are a young fan, and then here you are alongside Paul McGann, one of the real doctors.
Yeah, I was like 25, 26 at the time. And I'm obviously still impressively close to that age visually. Huge. It was a huge deal. In fact, the cast was a big old cast, you know, because obviously Sheridan was in it, Ian McNeice, Elspeth Gray. I mean, so there were some big old names in that production, and I enjoyed every second of it. It was great fun, and I loved the recording setup. it was so relaxed, and everyone was just very, very lovely. I was impressed at how, I remember at the time just being impressed at how quickly it worked, you know. One quick practice, run it through, recorded, done, right, next, turn the page.
If only all work was that easy.
If only, yeah, exactly.
So what do you remember about working with Sheridan? And of course, you got to be a bit of a romantic interest for her.
I just remember thinking how lovely she was. I mean, that's always been the sort of the overriding memory for me for any Big Finish production I've ever been a part of is how lovely everyone is. I think that probably is something to do with the intrinsic part of doing audio dramas, is because there's no hanging around. There's no, you know, there's no time for anyone to get on anyone else's nerves because you're basically recording a 45-minute or an hour-long drama in a day. So, you know, it's fun, it's exciting, it's quick. And she was amazing as well. I remember thinking at the time, I was like, oh, it's effortless for you. It's effortless. Oh, you know, nothing about her performance ever sounded like she was reading off the page. I remember thinking that very vividly at the time, that she was just immensely, and is immensely talented.
Yeah, because I think she and Paul very quickly established a working rapport, and it proved to be hugely popular with the fans, and I'm sure that didn't surprise you.
Well, no, not at all. I mean, chemistry is you know, super valuable in any form of acting, and yes, it's very clear on the audio that they did together how well they worked together as a pair.
Of course, this was one of the first stories in a whole new run, which was broadcast on BBC 7 before it was released by Big Finish. So again, that must have been something exciting for you, sort of like something new, a proper new series that was on BBC Radio.
Yeah, that was a huge deal for me. I was really excited about that. I've never really, at that point, I've not really listened to much audio drama. So I seem to remember it being broadcast before I had the physical CD copy of it sent to me. So I remember sort of just like sort of turning the lights off and putting on the radio. I think I listened to it through Sky. I think you could do that. I just sat down, sort of closed my eyes and listened to it. And it was, you know, it was, for me, I was like, oh wow, that's what they did with it. Wow, got it. They've really created a whole world here. You know, you see all the work that goes into sound effects, music, and it just, you know, how instantly it just creates something really special.
You mentioned earlier about the challenge of playing the 14-year-old, the 18-year-old, and then the 40-year-old and the 18-year-old. Would you say that's one of the biggest challenges you've had as an actor, just sort of to age your voice up a little, then to drop it younger, and then to try and get that combination of the two?
I think it would be now, weirdly. I think when I was younger, especially at that sort of age, you know, you talk about some 25 years old, I probably just had more confidence to just go in and do it. But I'd also, Barnaby was going to tell me if I was not hitting the right notes on that. The hardest part was how do you judge a book? I think I remember the hardest part being, it was when he'd had the mind of the 40-year-old general put in him, but he still needs to sound younger. But yeah, it was, at some point you just have to go, oh, just let it be. if it's wrong, they'll tell me it's wrong. In other ones, you know, I've played a couple of characters in one drama and have then had to kill myself or have a conversation with yourself. I found that probably more tricky, weirdly, just because, yeah, getting that to work. Yeah.
I thought did it really well. I thought there was the sort of like the youthful bounciness, and then there's this, then you start playing with it, it just sounds like a lot more confidence in the voice when you're doing it. That was sort of how it sounded to me. So it was just like sort of that world, you know, slightly more worldly experienced and just an extra confidence in there just to, rather than previously a lot more bouncy.
Yeah, I think it was also innocence as well, because, you know, he was an innocent and he was, you know, naive and all of those things. So I very much tried to play the young version of that as very innocent, because I thought it at the time it would just provide a much bigger distinction between the two, because obviously it's me doing the voices. I have a vague memory at the time that they thought at the time they might have somebody else play the older version. I think that's true. I think that's just popped into my head as a memory, but I think they then decided against it, which I don't know. Maybe that would have worked better from an audio perspective.
I think it works the fact you've got the same actor doing it, so that there's, and it's, so it's one of those ones you do need to double check that, because there is that distinct difference, and I think it works because I did double check when I was thinking. I was like, yeah, you were both. So there you go. You fooled me.
Oh, right. It worked.
Absolutely. Just what you planned all along. So, I mean, this, of course, with you having been a fan, this must have been one that family and friends must have been delighted about when you were finally able to talk about it.
Oh, absolutely. I told everybody about it. Yeah, I was like, now you might not know about this thing called BBC Radio 7, but on this day, at this time. Yeah, I was very excited about it. I was very excited just being allowed into the sort of world of Doctor Who and into Big Finish, who have always been so lovely to me and so incredible, and always call me up from time to time, going back and to do another one, which is so sweet and so lovely of them. But I definitely got to a point where I was sort of my ticking off doctors. I was like, okay, now I've worked with Sylvester, I've worked with Colin, I've worked with Paul,
I've worked with Peter. Yep.
Yeah, I will be honest, when I did Peter's, which was, I must ask, nearly 10 years ago, because it was for the it was part of Big Finish's sort of 50th anniversary range of stories, the fan for the Common Men. So when I knew that I was going to be doing a Peter story, I was sort of beyond excited about that, and then had to pretend that I wasn't when I was there in a room with him. And, you know, there was a point, I think, for like an hour where we would, it was just me and him sat in the green room while other people recording. And I'm sort of going, God, if my 4 or 5 year old self could know, it was great. It was brilliant.
Yeah, I completely get that. I once found myself in a room in my first job. It was virtually my leaving present. I'd been offered a new job, and in my previous job, it was in Aberdeenshire, of all places, remote, rural sort of town. And then Peter Davison was coming to open a Stone Circle trail. And there was no other media there. The TV crew was coming later on when he was up at the location. No other journalists came out to speak to him at the hotel. So I had him for a whole hour to myself. So I got the serious sort of, you know, the important stuff done for the job. And then I managed to go in and get the fan stuff done, and just, oh, it was heaven. But he thought it was hilarious.
Universally as well. I mean, I have to say that, I mean, they say never meet your heroes, but across the board, from all the Big Finishes that I've done, and all the sort of the doctors that I've been fortunate enough to work with, they have all just been so incredibly lovely and brilliant and sweet and funny, and they all have their stories. And, you know, I've just been regaled by Colin during a lunch, and I could have just sat and listened to his stories all day. They were just brilliant. They very much take on that role, and they're fantastic people to work with.
Yeah, you've got quite a decent Big Finish CV, and of course, more recently, you've done some Third Doctor Chronicles and 11th Doctor Chronicles as well.
Yes, actually, they've recently asked me to go back in to do something, which is nice. In fact, I'll be doing that in July, but I probably better not say what it is, because I'm sure these things are all top secret.
It's okay, I've signed a Big Finish NDA, so we're all good. I never asked
these. I always forget about that. You've got to think, I don't take photos of scripts and things like that.
Yep.
But yes, so I shall have to dust off my recording booth voice again.
Fantastic. David, it's been a real joy. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. It's been lovely. Thanks ever so much.
Thanks to David for taking the time to have a chat with us, and remember when he was God for a day.
I wouldn't mind being God for a day. Would you mind being a God for a day?
Maybe. I mean, I wouldn't mind, but I'm afraid it would go to my head and be like, no, I want to be a God forever now. So knowing my own personal tendencies, maybe that's not a good idea.
Okay, well, I will not confer deity status upon you today then. We'll keep it for another time.
Nah. So remember, if you enjoyed today's Pieces of Eight, or indeed liked any episode we've done, please do leave a review for us on iTunes or your podcast provider, as it means more people can find our episodes. And it's always appreciated. And you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Pieces of Eight.
Brilliant. And of course, that's it. This is episode 13. It's the end of the series.
Hello.
But is it?
Oh, but is it?
How many times
have question.
We... I know. How many times have we done an episode of... Or how many times have we done a series of 13 episodes and then carried on going? It's only one way to find out, really, isn't there?
Yeah.
Tune in next week.
Keep listening. Yeah.
Exactly. But big thanks to all of our interviewees throughout the season. And of course, in recent weeks, my co-hosts, David Steele, Matt Michael, and of course, the one, the only, my most favourite Belgian in the whole world ever, Tina Peters.
Thank you. I just love doing this. So yay.
Fantastic. But we should also, of course, send big hugs to our beloved Rebecca Chapman, who thinks...
Yes, Rebecca, we do miss you.
We do. In fact, maybe we should have an episode we could have the three of us all together, and we could have a...
That would be so much fun.
Oh, yes. Let's have a threesome.
Yeah, I was going to say something, but I'm just going to shut up now. So.
No, no, please, please carry on.
No, I'm not going to say anything.
No, we could probably all get into trouble. So yes, let's move on. But yep, we missed you, Becca. Even though you think having a baby is a good excuse for getting out of recording episodes with us, but shocking,
always an excuse.
Exactly. But yes, I'm sure that we'll hear those dulcet tones before far too long. So until the next time, I've been Kenny Smith.
And I was Tina Peters.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.